Miss Mary Blake.
Hey, jump her for two.
Tiny corner of this great big world to make the place we love. My home upon the hill, I find I love you still. I've been away, but now I'm back to tell you. San Francisco,
and of course the great Jeanette MacDonald, San Francisco, and everybody joins in. I hope you're doing it at home. And my guest is a man who sings the song of San Francisco so beautifully, James Smith. San Francisco's Lost Landmarks is his book, available from the KGO book line, 1-800-801-BOOK. Okay, wait a minute, I got to ask you this before I go to Playland at the Beach. I know Blackie's was a myth created for the screen, but we did have a Barbary Coast, did we not? And you write about the cafes, don't you?
Oh, yeah, we absolutely had a Barbary Coast. It's funny because it's been one of the more romantic areas all the way through, up and through Prohibition when it finally gave up the ghost. But it's a wonderful place.
All right. Now, talk to me a little bit about one of my favorite places, one of your favorite places growing up, Playland at the Beach.
Oh, my golly. Playland at the Beach. So it's one place. It was all about sounds, sights, smells. I mean, it was a place that was so tactile. It vibrated. You could hear the Big Dipper roaring down, you know, that old wooden coaster.
I'm looking at the picture. I love it.
Oh, it was wonderful. The screams and I remember at the time that I used to go. I mean, it was in the late 50s, and you'd see guys there with their girls and groups out on outings. And of course, everybody had to go to the fun house, and you go through the door, and there's that guy with the button blowing the air to blow the skirts
went
up.
Right up.
Oh, it was a riot. The barrel of fun in there, and of course, the great wooden slides.
Yep, and Playland really was a part of San Francisco, wasn't it? And when it fades, we really lost something.
Well, we lost a lot. I mean, San Francisco, that was the last city amusement park. And amusement parks are so critical to the heritage of a city because that's where people go to have fun. And now people leave the city to do that sort of thing.
Now, I've got to ask you, Gene Burns, one of my colleagues here at KGO, had his 65th birthday party out at the Cliff House. And you write so eloquently about the various incarnations of the Cliff House. By the way, the language in this book is marvelous, the descriptive use of words. Describe the incarnations of the Cliff House.
Well, the first Cliff House was not much more than a box out there. But again, it had that great view. And it always had great food. One of the things out there was that you wanted to be able to go out there, have a great time. Seafood in San Francisco, from the very start, was the best in the world. There is no better. So it was first built, far away from the city. You had to go out down a road that, a dirt road going out there, and it probably took half an hour to an hour to get there. So a lot of the politicians went out there, a lot of under-the-table dealings and whatnot, but it was a fun place. Presidents would head there, of course, all the businessmen in the town, deals were cut, it was the place to be. And they had events. They had tightrope walking between Seal Rocks and the in the Cliff House. They had swimming competitions, believe it or not, in those riptides going around Seal Rocks. But that first one, it got overcrowded quickly. So then they built this big wraparound. That's the second one. And in the second Cliff House, they had these big wings and just about tripled the size of the place. Now, what's fun there is that at one point, and, oh, I'm terrible on dates, but during that time, and it was after Adolf Sutro bought the place. Sutro bought it, by the way, because he wanted to clean the place up. He lived up in Sutro Heights above the Cliff House, and he looked down there, and he saw the revelry going down. He was a German, and he didn't mind the drinking, but he sure hated all the dealings going on and the lowlifes that were coming in. So he bought the place up. Shortly after he bought it, the Schooner Parallel was leaving the city.
Let's remind everybody, that was January 13th, 1887.
There you go. And so it hit the Golden Gate, and when it hit there, it caught a dead calm. There was no wind. There was no breeze. So they were sitting there tacking back and forth, trying to catch the slightest bit of a breeze to haul them out. Couldn't do it. And they saw themselves headed towards the rocks. The crew jumped ship, and over time, the tides drug it into the rocks right below the Cliff House. What wasn't known was that the ship was full of dynamite. It was full of kerosene, and it was full of blasting caps. This thing had the worst cargo you could imagine. So this thing is grinding itself away under the rocks. Sutro sent, this was in the middle of the night, Sutro sent his people down to see if there was anyone on board. There was no one on board. So he left a couple of guards standing up on the top and told them to keep an eye on things. Well, later on that evening, the blasting caps went off, and there was an explosion that rocketed up into the sky, blew those two men back hundreds of feet. They did not die. They survived the accident. There was a ship out by the Farallones, and it thought it hit a reef. It got slammed so hard with the blast. They heard the blast in Oakland. They heard it in San Jose. The whole city by morning was out at the Cliff House to see what was going on, and they blew a whole wing off the Cliff House. It was amazing.
Now, the Cliff House is rebuilt, and there is, it survives the earthquake and fire of 1906, but then something happens on September 7th, 1907.
Yeah, so, well, we got a little bit ahead of ourselves.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm just moving ahead. You know, yeah, my job is to move us along.
You're moving us along, and I got to tell the story.
Okay.
So, in Christmas of, what was it, 1894, I think, 1896, somewhere around there, they had a kitchen fire, chimney fire, and the second Cliff House burnt to the ground. So Sutro said he's going to build a monument for the city. And that's when he built the famous Cliff House, the French Chateau style.
Mm-hmm.
And that was gorgeous. By the way, if you want to see it, there's a website out there called Cliff House Project, run by Gary Stark. And he actually has a virtual tour of it. So you got to go out there and see that. Anyway, that one lasted until 1907, as you said. And they were doing it survived the earthquake. So the 1906 quake did a little bit of damage, not much. So they were doing some repair work, and it caught fire, and it burned to the ground. And I know there's some famous pictures out there of that thing burning.
And you have some in your book.
Yeah, it was hard to pick because there's so many good ones. But that was the one I've got is the one I like the best.
Now, in addition to all that, Sutro builds his baths. And I remember the building because I remember going ice skating there. And I remember when it burned down. Oh,
oh
boy.
Yeah.
But now, the Sutro baths were amazing, were they not?
Well, that was the biggest natatorium in the world at the time. Sutro didn't do things by halves, and he wanted the biggest and the best. It was a saltwater natatorium. That thing he could change the water in one change of the tides because he had these big tunnels that went out into the ocean. And when the tide would go out, he'd pull the plug, and those things would drain just like a big bathtub.
Now, my understanding is those tunnels are still there.
The tunnels are still there. Oh, yeah, all the works are still there.
Gee.
So you can actually go down, crawl among the rocks, and you can see what's there.
I actually saw a tour being led down there. They don't want people to climb. We need to emphasize this. You're not supposed to go down there alone.
Right. You have to
set up for a tour. They have rangers, and you got to set up for a tour. But it's spectacular.
Oh, it is. And it's just... It was such a fun place, you know. I mean, it's fun when you run across. I missed the bass. I was there for the ice skating, just like John. But when you talk to people who used to go to the bass, and they had to wear those horrible
swimming suits.
Oh, they were made out of wool.
Yeah.
And by the time you got out of the pool and you got to the changing rooms, they were ice cold and clammy, and could hardly pull the thing off. But it was a great time. It cost a nickel to ride Sutro's trolley down there. It cost a dime to get in. And if you wanted to swim, it was a quarter for entrance and the swim.
And the laundry.
And the laundry. Yeah, yeah. You got soap, you got a towel, and you got that nasty bathing suit.
I love it. I love it. I love it. Now, when it burned down in 1966,
right?
It was part of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, and it couldn't be rebuilt.
Well, it was actually slated to be torn down anyway,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't part of the National Recreation Area at that time. It belonged to a developer, and he was
Jeremy Etzokin.
That's right. And he was going to put apartments or condos up there. And people put up such a cry and hue on that thing, hue and cry. Anyway, they stopped him from doing anything. He couldn't make any headway, so finally he just gave up.
All right, now I got a million callers here. Let me go to Matt calling from Ignacio. Hey, Matt, welcome to KGO.
Howdy, folks. Hey, I got two quick questions. Question one, what major landmarks, if any, were lost to the San Francisco earthquake of 1906?
You know, there were quite a few, but mostly it was in the business district. I mean, you had things like the Grand Hotel and whatnot. We didn't lose as many as one would think. I mean, as I was going through it, I found that as far as losses to San Francisco, the big loss was loss of life, and it goes way beyond what was ever stated.
Mm.
Some of the big landmarks, the Monkey Block out of Montgomery, that stood. The Palace Hotel, it stood. You know, it lasted through it. I mean, it got gutted, but they rebuilt it.
Yeah, the Fairmont Hotel.
Oh, yeah. The Fairmont Hotel was ready to open, and they had to put that off for a couple of years while they refurbished, but it stood. St. Francis, same thing. They stood.
Yeah. Now, so, what was your second question, Matt?
Okay, second and final question. What's the storyline on Seal Stadium and Candlestick Park? And I'll listen to you.
Great, great. Seal Stadium. Boy, I remember that
man.
Vividly.
That was great.
Now it's a car lot or
something. Yeah, it's gone. So I remember going to Seal Stadium as a kid. And
Lefty O'Doul.
And you were right out there. I mean, you'd sit there and you could talk to the players. It was just, it was a small stadium. They said, it's too small for the Giants. So... you know, it couldn't hold the crowds. So they stuck us out at Candlestick Point. And from then on, we froze.
Hmm. I have to tell you, I used to have George Christopher here on the program periodically. He's a wonderful man and a good friend. And he always defended Candlestick Park. He loved.
Oh, yeah.
And it'll always be Candlestick Park to me. I want you to know that. No matter what monstrous name they give it. My guest is James R. Smith. His book, San Francisco Landmarks, available from the KGO book line, 1-800-801-BOOK. This morning, we celebrate San Francisco. And sitting in the studio with me is James Smith. His book, San Francisco's Lost Landmarks, available from the KGO book line, 1-800-801-BOOK. By the way, this is Bronslow Caper at the piano. He's the composer of San Francisco. I love it. 8080810 is the number. Robert, calling from San Francisco. Robert, welcome to KGO.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I'd like to ask the author, what was the politics and who was behind the demolishing of the City of Paris building?
So the City of Paris building was not demolished. It's still there. It's now Neiman Marcus.
Or as we affectionately call it, needless markup.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, they still got their, you know, they got the furs and everything the City of Paris had.
But I was part of the committee that fought to save the glass cupola there
because
they were going to demolish the whole thing.
Every time I go in there, you know, I got to crank my neck up and take a look at that. So that's, if you look up at the top of that thing, you see the ship, City of Paris, and that's what it was named for.
Marvelous. And the building is there, and in fact, every holiday season, when we walk around to see all the stores downtown, we always go into the City of Paris and look up.
Their tree has been famous forever. It goes up stories high. And I always wonder, how do they get it in there?
The great mystery. Okay, Robert?
Okay.
All right, pal.
In other words, they took care of the facade. The facade. They didn't...
They adjusted the inside. If you remember, there were ramps.
Right.
And you could walk up the floors. Those are gone now.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
They did the renovation. The same thing they're doing now over at the old Emporium. Anyway, good, Robert. Thanks a million. 8080810. Richard, calling from Richmond. Whoops, where are you, Richard? Oh, there you are. You're at 7. Hey, Richard, welcome to KGO.
Good morning, John. Great show. I'm a native of San Francisco. There's four things I'd like to have the author discuss. Number one is Woodward's Gardens. Number two is I've heard a rumor that Van Ness is so wide because it was in 1906.
It was the fire line of 1906. That's correct.
That's correct, yeah.
Yes, the Army Corps of Engineers actually dynamited from Market Street all the way out to the bay as a fire break.
Of course, they made the fire worse, you know.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. They were just going nuts with that, and the cinders blowing away from the dynamite was setting off more buildings that hadn't gone. A lot of those buildings were filled with gas. The gas lines broke, and so all it took was a spark, and the Army was good enough to provide that spark.
All right, third question.
And, you know, on Scott Street between Bush and Pine, there are four houses which are extremely small, and I think that they were thrown together right after the earthquake in 1906. And also on Scott Street between Bush and Pine, there is one residence which was authorized by the City of San Francisco to install gas street lamps, and they are active gas street lamps in use today.
Wow, that's news to me.
No, that's great. Woodward Gardens.
If you go on Scott Street between Bush and Pine, on the east side of the street, you will see two gas street lamps.
I'm going to check that on the way
I'll
home.
Yeah, I'll have to check that myself.
Richard, we talked about Woodward's Gardens at the beginning of the program. You may have missed it. Was there a particular question you had about Woodward Gardens?
No, I just missed it. I didn't have anything in particular.
When you buy the book, San Francisco's Lost Landmarks, available from the KGO book line, 1-800-801-BOOK. Not only is there a whole section on Woodward's, but also all of the pictures. It's marvelous.
And there's one last comment I'd like to make. I was walking under the bridge anchorage right off of 2nd Street, and I noticed a plaque to Rincon Hill. And on that plaque, it made a comment about there was a hospital in that location.
That's correct. There was, years ago. And they did acknowledge that. Of course, I'll tell you, Richard, I walked by the Rincon Annex, and if you look at the plaque on the side, it was dedicated by Henry Morgenthau, Jr., as Secretary of the Treasury, and James Farley as Postmaster General. I got a big kick out of that. Hey, Richard, thanks a million.
One thing about Rincon Hill is it's been cut down. I mean, we talked about the 2nd Street cut. And then they leveled the whole hill after that. They have been trying to level that thing for years. And the final step, of course, was when in 1936 they leveled it one more time to anchor the bridge. But that was a hill that rivaled Nob Hill. It had beautiful mansions at the top. And that's where the rich came so they could see what was going on in the bay. See their ships coming in with all the goods.
If the environmentalists had been around then, the topography of this city would have been profoundly different, would it not?
Oh, yeah, but we'd be much poorer for it, too, I'm afraid.
Now, we were talking about Finocchio's a few minutes ago and some of the other great clubs here in town. Talk about those.
So Finocchio's started about 1936, And it actually got going doing, you know, as a drag club, with the idea of just providing a different type of entertainment. It was a place at first where the gay crowd could go, but it soon started drawing drawing tourists and whatnot. That went all the way up into 1999 when it finally closed, just because of lack of interest. It just kind of gave up the ghost.
And you also talk about the old poodle dog.
Oh yeah,
and it's various.
But let me go back to Finocchio's.
Okay,
for a minute.
All right.
So one of the things that was great about Finocchio's, as opposed to some of these other clubs, is that the people at Finocchio's actually did. The guys actually sang, and they were good. So a friend of mine, David D'Alba, used to do Judy Garland.
I remember.
And he was wonderful. I've got some of his recordings. As a matter of fact, he's got a website, daviddealba.com. And that's David-D-E-A-L-B-A. And you can still buy CDs and pictures and whatnot of what Finocchio's was. When they stopped with the, performers stopped singing, when they started lip-syncing, is when it started sinking a little bit, yeah. I'm afraid.
I can
because
remember,
it was hard to find guys that could do that.
Yeah, I remember going there and seeing that very show, the Judy Garland show. Absolutely marvelous.
Oh, it was wonderful.
Just a great
and I mean, David just lived the role. Right. It was so exciting.
Now, talk about the old poodle dog, which went through so many different reincarnations.
Oh, yeah. Well, the poodle dog started right 1849, and it was a couple of French guys, and the French came, and they were in what's now Chinatown. So they found that the Californians, the new Californians, had an appetite for good food, and they provided good food at a reasonable price. It got its name in one of maybe three ways. Number one, some said it was called, I can't even pronounce it, Le Poulet d'Or or something like that, which was basically the golden chicken. Another one they said it was, and then guys couldn't pronounce it. These 49ers couldn't pronounce it, so they just called it the poodle dog. Another one was they had a dog there. It was a poodle, big black standard poodle, named Ami. And Ami was the maitre d' of the restaurant. He would actually greet the customers and follow them as they went to their seats. So people just said, hey, let's go to the poodle dog, because that's all they could remember. They didn't remember the name of the place. And then there's a third one that is sort of a variation of that. But people would come there, and they served good wine, good French wine, which was the start to California being a wine country. People came to enjoy wine because they were getting it with their meals, which they never did when they were back east. So the poodle dog started the progression of French restaurants in the city, and it lasted all the way up into the 80s. Tremendous French food. I mean, it was just the best.
My guest is James Smith. We're only scratching the surface. If I told you how much is in this book, you wouldn't believe it. It is just marvelous. San Francisco's Lost Landmarks, available from the KGO book line, 1-800-801-BOOK. This is John Rothman. My guest, James Smith, San Francisco's Lost Landmarks, available from the KGO book line, 1-800-801-BOOK. Talk to me about the jazz clubs on Fillmore Street.
So Fillmore was originally a Japanese settlement. And during World War II, of course, we were kind enough to relocate all those good people. When the war started, a lot of African-Americans came from the South to work in the shipyards. And so naturally there was a hole there of places available, so they moved to the Fillmore. They brought with them their music, the jazz. It was the greatest area in the city for music at that time. The Barbary Coast had died out. There was no other place you could hear great jazz than there. And San Francisco had its own style of jazz, and they just kept adding to it. They had some of the greatest performers of the times. So David Johnson has provided some photographs of that for my book. He's a photographer that actually took pictures of those clubs in the 1940s and 1950s. Mm-hmm. But
I can remember, I have to tell you, I was a kid, but I can remember going down to the Fillmore in the 1950s, and my father was a doctor, and he had a lot of patients in that area. And I would pass these clubs, and I could hear the music. And it was just riveting. Let me go to Marty, calling from Daly City. Marty, welcome to KGO.
Hi, John.
Hey, Marty.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Yeah, I used to work at, I'm native San Francisco, but I used to work at Sutro's. And while I was in high school for a couple of years in the early 50s, and I was well familiar. I was a part of the time I was an ice guard, and part of the time lifeguard in the pool, and part of the time I was a mummy guard. They had that Egyptian mummy collection out there.
I remember that so well.
Oh, those used to scare the daylights out of me. They had them unwrapped. And,
yeah, well, they were afraid they'd lose some of them. And they also had the Tom Thumb collection there. And a lot of that stuff is still down there at...
the Musée Mécanique. At the Musée Mécanique run by...
Musée Mécanique was next door.
Yeah. No, no, but now... I think a lot of the material Danny Zielinski takes care of down at the Musée Mécanique, which is absolutely marvelous down on the wharf now.
Yeah, that's what, Pier 45, isn't
it? Yep,
yep. Yeah, we were an ice skating family, our whole family, and I used to take lessons there, and I was skating at least 5 hours a day and ended up getting a job there while I was after school.
That's
used
great.
To climb up and down all those stairs and take the trolley out through Point Lobos there, and it would end up right next door at... Louis' restaurant there.
Which is still there.
Louis is owned by part of the Hontalas family, who is also related to Danny Hontalas, who owns the Cliff House.
Right. Well, they lease it there. And I went to school with one of the Hontalas boys who unfortunately died. And they do just a marvelous job. And, of course, Louis survived. And it's aside from the Cliff House itself.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely great.
It's quite a history in that place. And when I started working for them, Sutro still owned it. He was a big guy, bald head, really big man. And then he sold out to the Whitney brothers that owned Playland. And I think eventually they had a fellow named Floyd Gilman was the management for Sutro's and Playland.
Well, I'm glad you called, Marty. You're living history.
Yeah, oh, we had a lot of fun there.
All right, pal. Thanks a million.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. And I have to say, the Hontalases, if you're listening, and I know occasionally they do, what they've done at the Cliff House is absolutely marvelous. And three cheers for the Hontalas family and everything they've done to preserve that wonderful heritage and tradition.
Oh, it's great.
And I would point out, I got to point out, they're also graduates of Washington High School. I point that out gladly. Go ahead.
Yeah, so they're... their clam chowder there is absolutely the best. So if you haven't been down there since they redid it, you got to go.
That's right. And when you go there, make sure you bring along San Francisco's Lost Landmarks. Have your cup of soup. Have a cup of coffee. Take a look at the magnificent view and read James Smith's book, which happens to be available from the KGO book line, 1-800-801-BOOK. When we come back, more of your calls and I cannot let him go. Without talking about the fairs of San Francisco. No, I didn't say affairs, ladies and gentlemen, although we'll talk about that in a few weeks. The fairs of San Francisco. Right here on KGO, I'm John Rothman. It is 5:48. We're just sitting here chatting, and I want to remind everybody that in 2 weeks, 2 weeks from now, my guest is the author of a marvelous book called Murder by the Bay. Mr. Adams wrote this book. It describes all of the great murders in the history of San Francisco. That's 2 weeks from now, same publisher, so we're being consistent. And, of course, this all leads up to our magnificent celebration here of the 100th anniversary of the earthquake and fire, which, of course, will be marked on April the 18th, 1906, and we'll do a great show, I can tell you. All right, let me go to Terrence, calling from San Francisco. Terrence, welcome to KGO.
Hi. A couple of comments. One of the problems we had with a lot of these monuments was, frankly, developers moving too fast. My father was on the Recreation and Park Committee that worked on the development of Candlestick Park, and they warned Harney repeatedly with Candlestick Park that if they didn't handle the cliff problem, they were going to have very strange weather conditions and very strange air conditions that would blow baseballs in all sorts of crazy directions. and Harney was in such a hurry, he refused to take any warnings.
Yep.
The result was when they built Candlestick Park, they had baseballs that would set records going one direction or another on air
cards. I love it, Jerry.
Yeah, but you know, that's typical for San Francisco.
Yeah.
We always have moved ahead as quickly as possible. We're always in high gear, and that'll never change. That's what makes us who we are. So, yeah, they screwed up. They screwed up big time. But then again, what would you have to talk about if you didn't have the stick?
That's right.
It happened in several places. Also, another place where when they were tearing down Playland, which, by the way, I loved as a kid, they ripped through it so quick that unfortunately when they were tearing it all down, one of the guys in the bulldozer hit the Tunnel of Love. His bulldozer turned over and killed him.
Oh, my.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah. But, you know, I remember Playland. You know what I love? The diving bell.
Yeah.
Went
oh,
down.
Oh, yeah, I was down there many times.
Right. My cousin actually got stuck. The thing got stuck on the bottom for, I don't know, 20 minutes. I've got to ask her about that. She used to have me in stitches telling me that story. Hey, Terry, thanks a million. Great
right.
reminiscence. And,
right.
of course,
by the way, yep. one thing.
Yep.
Another thing collection they should have cataloged, never did, was the Egyptian collection. They had Ushabti shells of them, and they never did translations or anything else.
Yeah.
I think some of them ended up in the Rosicrucian Egyptian Museum.
Boy. All right, Terry. Terry Best Faulkner, wishes. By the way, a dear friend, and it's always a pleasure when you call, Terry.
Best wishes.
Thanks, pal. Let's go to Helen, calling from San Francisco. Helen, welcome to KGO. Hi, Helen.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
It's a beautiful day in San Francisco. Hello.
Yes, I always say every day is a beautiful day in San Francisco.
I was born in this house, what I'm calling it even now, in 1914. That makes me 91 years old.
My goodness, and you're still in the same house?
Hello?
Yep, you're still in the same house.
Bless you.
Oh, she's got a radio on. Helen, I want to tell you, we're delighted you called, and all I can say is, I hope you stay in that house for many more years.
I worked for Hale Brothers for 32 years.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
I can tell you all about Bernal Heights. Hello?
I used to climb Bernal Heights when I was a kid, go up there and fly kites.
Absolutely great. Hey, Helen, thanks a million for your call.
And I don't think I'll move. I went to Steel Stadium. Hello?
Yes, yes.
I went to Old Rec for Four Sail Stadium, and the ladies couldn't sit in certain sections because that's where they had the who's gal for the men with the, with the drinks.
I love it. Hey, Helen, you're a kick. Thanks for calling.
Bye.
Bye-bye, dear. Bye. Thank you. Oh, I love that. I love it. That's great. Now, wait, I got to ask you about the fairs, beginning with the exposition in 1893 and moving up to 1914 and then 1939. We've had some great world fairs.
Oh, yeah. We've had wonderful world fairs. So in 1892, they had the Chicago World's Fair, and it was closing in 1893. It was a good fair, Charles DeYoung was there. He was leading the San Francisco, the California contingent, actually. And he says, you know, we got to bring this fair out to San Francisco. So, naturally, everywhere else is socked in snow and whatnot in the country. In our winter, you know, we've got beautiful weather. So we said, let's have a winter fair. They opened the winter fair there just before the start of 1894. And it went on all the way through 4th of July, and it was a huge hit. They brought the best of the Chicago World's Fair.
And a lot of the building we now have in Golden Gate Park was a result of that, and many of the statues and so forth.
A lot of the statues, a lot of the big pavilion there, the music pavilion and whatnot, was originally dug for the fair, and the track around that where people can stroll, that was the main concourse for the fair. So the DeYoung Museum was the last building that remained from that, and of course that's gone too now.
Yeah, it was. I hated to see it go. I got to tell you, but
yeah. That'll be in the next book.
1914, the exposition.
1914, they started building the Pan Pacific Fair. And the reason for that was to show that, hey, we'd come back from the quake. So they went out to Washerwoman's Cove there, and they filled all that in. They sucked all that silt out of the bay, filled that area in, and built the most wonderful fair ever.
And we now are blessed that we still have the Palace of Fine Arts.
Oh, yeah.
In large measure, thanks to Walter Johnson and his $5 million bequest.
The fun thing about that one is, it's not really fun if you want to talk about it, but the fun thing is that they built that with silt to celebrate the rebuilding from the quake. And, of course, in Loma Prieta in 1989, that area was, it liquefied and the houses sunk back down again.
Yeah,
so
there's
back to the bay.
Now, in 1939, the great World's Fair on the eve of the European War, the building of Treasure Island.
Yeah, that was another one. They built a big cofferdam around that thing, and then they sucked the silt and the mud in and filled that thing up. Of course, they put rocks around the outside and whatnot, so it was done a lot better than the Marina District. Mm-hmm. The reason they call it Treasure Island is that the diggings had washed down on the bay. And that was the leavings of the treasure from the 49ers. So it wasn't just, based on a book. It was based on the fact that there was probably actually gold dust in there.
Boy, oh boy. John from San Francisco has a quick question for you. John, welcome to KGO.
Hello.
Yes, John.
John?
Yes.
Hello, John.
Have you any idea, or has anyone mentioned what might have happened to Laughing Sal?
Well, that's a good question. Let me tell you, Laughing Sal is in two places right now.
Okay.
Laughing Sal is down in Pier 45 at the Musée Mécanique. And you can see her there any day. You can go down there and you can push the button and you can hear her take off like she used to. She is also down at Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk,
but not laughing. She just stands there.
Yeah. So, there was more than one. We had at least two in San Francisco. You couldn't have just one because they'd break down once in a while. So they had a backup. But beyond that, there were about 400 of those built, and they went to fun houses all across the country. So she's not unique, although the term...
Playland.
You walk on down to the Musée Mécanique, and Danny Zielinski, who does such a great job, Ed Zielinski's son. Ed died last year, of course, but his son Danny is keeping up that tradition. Just marvelous. Now, we're down to our last minute or so here, and I've just got to ask you, because you've written such a great book, and I've left so much out, I'm almost ashamed of myself. But James Smith, San Francisco's Lost Landmarks, what did you want people to take away from this book? What do you want people to know?
The big thing is that it's fun. The history of San Francisco is a fun thing. Yeah, we've got a lot of serious stuff, and you can get into politics and whatnot, but there's such great stories about the city, and that's what I wanted people to take away from it, to just see the fact that we are in transition. People say, oh, it's an immoral city. No, it's not immoral. It's amoral. We live and let live, and we enjoy the hell out of ourselves. So that's the big thing. One of the things if you're interested, I'll be doing a book talk at Bay Books in San Ramon, and that'll be on February 23rd at 7 o'clock. You can see my events. They should be upcoming on my website at historysmith.com.
That's historysmith.com.
And that's got the www in front, by the way.
Now, for the book, all you got to do is call San Francisco's Lost Landmarks. For that book, all you have to do is call the KGO book line, 1-800-801-BOOK. James, thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Just a delight. Now, I also should tell you that one of James's colleagues is going to join me 2 weeks from today on Murders by the Bay. You're not going to believe it.
And that is a great book.
All right. We're going to have a lot of fun.